You know, it's crazy, like, you know, Tin Can Phone, it started in prison, you know, and when we came home, they kept, like, our first interviews and all of our first content in bondage. We had to start over, you know what I'm saying? We lost our mom and we lost Joe, but we gained Blue. Tin Can Phone.
Did that time and I bounced back. Had us in the beanies, now snap back. Boys in blue trying to snap back. Trying to make sure that my guys never go back. Ain't worried about the instas and the Snapchats. I'm worried about the homies on drugs. Close to really fast. It's messed up when you know the dealer and the buyer. Look him in his eyes, I can tell if he lying. Been locked up with gorillas in the lines. Yeah, respect it, get you far and don't move around blind. Forget about the chow hall, I ain't waiting in line. Bust down on the bed, spread with the homies. Not no more, we on the streets waiting for him. Free such and such, free with the wop. We all on cable talking it out. Me, Mike, and Blue and a couple of guests. And knowledge like petrol, who got the gas? Blue went to work, trying to heal for my past. Politicking on the yard, trying to touch me a bag. Mike was on the yard with the hitters in the sav. Orange beanie on his head with the thing in the bag. Blue photo shoot fresh, sharp enough to cut a wrist. First day of school, cooling ain't with the cuddling. Tin Can Phone, yes, gang in the pit. Tin Can Phone, yes, gang in the pit. Tin Can Phone, yes, gang in the
pit. Mike, Blue, Queens.
We're moving in to a new apartment, and it's my employer is going to get it, and then I would just use the place at times, and I would pay most of the rent and through a friend, and looks like that'll be cool for a while.
So you're not on the paper?
It's not that kind of thing, because it's not long.
Sure, 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 sure.
If I wanted to be on the paper, I could be on the
paper. Of course.
It's like
but someone's helping, like before I thought it was just convenient for them when we talked about it, but it sounds like also there's some bypassing of unfortunate box checking.
Right. Well, and I've thought about all the different ways to get a place. You know, like, what if I had, you know, what do I need to do to buy a place, right? You need to have all the money, right? You know what I mean? If you can save $300,000, it's yours.
Oh, no.
If I have $275,000, can I get the last $25,000? Nope. You know, it's just like so weird. I can't get a Best Buy credit card.
Hey, Blue.
$5,000 and be like, I want that computer. And then like,
it's okay. I couldn't get Target. Don't feel bad.
Yeah.
Hey, Blue.
Yeah.
I have a question. Have you experienced, a situation where it looked like you would have white privilege and then your record kind of like snatched it from you to where you actually felt it or realized it?
I think absolutely. Like, I know that I like pass, like people don't, I have a nuanced self-identity and either I get it or not, which is Jewish, which means that I don't actually identify as white.
Oh yeah.
I know that I benefit every day from white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I have definitely felt that. I've seen, it was, you know, not long into my release, but times when I was looking for jobs with different places in the community, and I knew I had all these things to offer and these people liked me, and then you did over a decade in prison, you know, like, what, you know, that doesn't jibe with what I see, you know, but
thanks.
It's powerful. So yeah, I mean, that has derailed things, but at the same time, I'm very fortunate, and in my life at this point, I have just like allowed myself to sit in that flow of life and go with it. And I'm in a really great position. I've been fortunate, well, an artist, but yeah.
I asked that because like I talk to people and I ask people about that, about like, and a lot of people try to ignore their white privilege and that it actually exists. So I just know the feeling of loss. So to know that for that one reason, something was taken from you, I noticed when you talk, you kind of, you let us know that you most definitely suffer from the same thing with pre-incarceration. So it's like, when you had that sense of loss, like I could just tell when you talk, like you like F that white privilege type situation, F this, because you have experienced what it's experienced to be discriminated against in a sense. So you kind of, until you had that feeling, you can't really, like, you know? So it's like, that's the only reason I ask, because a lot of people try to ignore as if they don't know that it exists or that they get it. And, you know, thank you though for that.
Absolutely. It's an interesting life inside too, where you're actually hanging around guys that have like swastikas, like
Yeah.
Tattooed on their face, you know.
I mean, hey, that's
studio Nazis usually, but
still. It's capped though because like even when I was in the pen, like a lot of them, I'm talking about hate tattooed across the stomach, big swastikas, big. You feel me? I listen to Tupac though. I really like Biggie Smalls. Like, come on, man. Yeah, like you just only hate son, you know? So yeah, that'd be bad. But what I'm realizing too, bro, is like when you raised in the streets. Man, it's so hard for me dealing with Medi-Cal. It's hard for me dealing with like tax people on the phone. Like my partner, like I promise you, for like I don't know how many months they owe me like $600 and some, $700. I never called them, never emailed, never, just because I cannot deal with I didn't have the patience. I like the way they talked to me, I felt like they knew who I was and they talked to me a certain way. Right. So like I feel like it's important what she's doing too in allowing our people to work with her. And I say our people, they're recently incarcerated, because it's hard enough to do taxes. You know what I'm saying? It's hard enough to have a boss that, again, you don't understand me. You don't understand what I come from. You don't understand where I just came from. You don't understand that at any time I could be going back here. But like, my partner had to, like, she really, like, three-way me and them. And, like, I'd be having to ask them, like, man, could you talk to her? Like, this is who I am. Like, because I don't really be knowing how to, like, I don't be knowing what to ask. I don't feel qualified to talk to them people because of the brainwash. You know what I'm saying? I never felt on the correct level. And then being in the streets, everything is tax-free. So I don't need to file taxes. You know what I'm saying? Like, but nobody talks about it. Nobody, Medi-Cal, bruh, like, do you not know, like, if you ain't got Medi-Cal, you pay taxes at the end of the year? Like, you gotta pay them. So so these is things that I feel like in there, they do give financial classes and they do give how to get a job classes, but there's a lot of real life experiences that the recently incarcerated, like that, I mean, depending on when you go in, again, I went in at 19 and came home at 29. So depending on when you go in, you know, like there's a lot, you feel me? Automatic payment, like you said, with bank accounts, I don't trust automatic payments because like, what if I ain't got all of it though? You gonna just put me in the negative? Like, you feel me? Like, so it just, like, for a long time, it's like, I'm gonna go get a money order. I'm gonna just give you what you feel me? Like, I can't, you know? But I feel like to have somebody like her to be your boss and to understand, you know, when you come in with a mug one day, I may not be feeling it. You know what I'm facing. You know what I've been through. Relapse, like, I just want to say I appreciate you and for everybody who come from this life, who walked them yards, you know, who put that blue uniform on. You know what I'm saying? You're doing a great thing and it's appreciated, you know what I'm saying, from the whole community.
Thank you. No, it's definitely been, like, when they come work here, I know they're definitely coming. Obviously, like, this is a for-profit and it's going to get my son to college, but I think it's important that nobody ever asked me who I wanted to become in the world. Everybody was like, what do you want to do? Like, I have two business degrees, but that's not, people say my name, that's not what I want them to think about. Like, I want them to, hey, that's the girl that shows up for the community. She's the voice for the voiceless. And so when you come and work for me, I'm like, okay, well, who do you want to become? What do you want to do? And so my main girl, she came with me, she seen me on the news and she was fighting a case. And she's, the first week I opened, she's like, please, can I come work for you? And she came and she worked for me and she just started college 2 weeks ago. And so for me, that's success. And so she wants to do nails. And I have another girl that she wants to start her own business and doing waxing. And so how can I assist you to become, because this is just a launching pad. You can't stay, you cannot stay here. So I will be your friend and I will be your therapist and your mom and your mentor. And I always encourage other people, like, you know, there's so much you can do for people. There's so much, like, and so I have a life insurance agent coming on the 2nd of July, because who knows? I'm so tired seeing GoFundMe. Like, who knows about, where is it talk in the Black community about life insurance? Who knows about that? I didn't until I was dang near 30. And so he's going to come and he's going to set up and he's just going to teach people about life insurance that come in and out. So just providing that space, when you're talking about the Oregon Health Plan, the Oregon Health Authority did this big survey and the Black and Brown community say that it's too hard to fill out the application. It's too hard to communicate. And so I'm training now to become somebody that can walk them through doing the application. Mm-hmm. So that's something people can do. Yeah. Again, people are always like, I don't know how you do it. I couldn't, there's so many
it's like literally things. Basic skills. Mm-hmm. Like you could teach basic skills, you know, even just like mock interview, like literally just so showing up or cheerleading. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Luke before when he was talking about, like, if you check the box, then you get discriminated against. Yeah. It's funny, I was actually talking to someone recently. I was like, if you're an abolitionist, I don't know what it means to hold someone's crime against them after they get out. Doesn't even matter what it was. Yeah. Vicious murder, whatever. Because if you already think that the system should be unmade, but the person has supposedly given it back to the whatever, whatever they think's gonna happen when you go to jail, and then they hold your record and they continue to hold it against you, like the state, right? And so then you have abolitionists like, well, what was the crime? And it's like, well, come on, like, when does it stop?
Yeah.
Because if it doesn't, then what are we doing this for? You know, even the system itself is like, okay, we want to rehabilitate after we traumatize. But, you know, then it's like, well, where are you putting people after their parole? What kind of jobs are they eligible for? They can't work the ones they were trained to do inside, you know? And so this is, that's the thing that really, again, calls me to this work. It seems like the general mass also just actually has no idea this is happening. Yeah. And also because folks who have incarcerated experience, you know, like you said, we were talking before, you have to apply, you don't want to check the box again. Who wants to do that? But it's like hard for me to get a place. Yeah. And so that extra layer is like, how can you even think you want
to
do it?
That's what I think raises some of what makes it even difficult for me to think about of how my peers may experience life when it's difficult for me. And I have a college education, and I still, when it was about CVs and grant writing, I'm like, Michael, help. Like, Kirk, help. Like, come here and like sit with me and do this thing. And I don't care if you're good at taxes or not. If you haven't done them for 10 years, they're crazy.
Yeah.
It's all hard. And I think that it's a myth to say that it should. We need, I think, people to just sit with us and just be like, I got you. And probably Michael needs me to sit with him sometimes. And
like, do you ask for it though?
No.
What's say that? Again?
Do you ask for it?
Yeah, I'm not afraid to ask. I'm not afraid to get some help.
But think about the masses of the guys coming home though.
Yeah, like, no, they don't want to be hurt. I mean, it's
just imagine if you would have had like a buddy or a mentor, at least for that first 30 days of transition. Because nobody, I mean, that's for me, nobody talks about the first, say my first week, 2 weeks. I wanted to go back. I wanted to go back because it was safe. It was structured. I knew where I was going. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do out here. I didn't really know how to go get a job. And I was in a halfway house. And so it was prison for me, was safe. And so if I would have had that one person that I knew that I could call on that maybe had that life experience or didn't have that, that was just like that constant support for that first 30 days, imagine how easier the transition would have been. For me, like I definitely probably would have been having panic attacks in Ross downtown.
My first week, I'm sorry that happened. That's horrible.
I survived.
Yeah. My first week out, I went to the PSU art and social practice like thing down at City Hall. I showed up. I was like, here I am. I'm like, hey, we love you. Or we at least like you. Or we don't hate you. And we did art and we talked about art and did stuff. And the art community was like, that was a big deal. I mean, it's like, that's what everybody needs is like somebody who says, yes, like we see you and we want you as a part of our community, as opposed to, nope, you can't live here. No, we're not going to do this. No, you can't have this job. We need everybody to be like, hey, who are you? What do you want? Like you said, we need everybody to be like that.
It's important to build community. I was blessed this time because I was a part of, it wasn't even Tin Can Phone. It was Arts and Social Practice. When I first came home, like that's who I was in contact with. I was a part of Liberation Literacy. These are the people who, when I came home, you know, like I'm talking about rides to see my PO, rides to go take UAs. Mike, man, I don't even know where Mike was living, but he was popping up downtown. Let's go. You over here? I'm near. I'm like, damn, you walk? You walk up with the dog. I'm like, you walked here? Like, you just popping up. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, that, and I always say that's why people join gangs, the camaraderie. Always, like, one thing I know for sure, I could call the homie. Like, you know, the rules is crazy. I could be in bed with the wife 2 in the morning. A homie call, I'm up. Where you at? I'm coming to get you. that's that loyalty of your brothers of the gang. So when you have that in somebody else that's trying to help you do right, like I call Mike, me and Mike don't agree on everything, but we finna figure it out and we gonna get some understanding. And I understand that he can agree with me when I'm falling off the wagon. So it's important to, and my brother Ben always said, it's important to build community. Because, like, man, without them, like, that's Arts and Social. That was, like, a program. That wasn't supposed to be a lifetime friend. Michael wasn't supposed to be a part of my life. Like, you just supposed to be here while I'm in here and so I can have something to do and not sit on my bunk. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what it's supposed to be. That's how it's set up to be. But when you build that community and you see that it's genuine, just showing up, and I always speak, showing up is the most important, because usually with childhood trauma, we're always let down. You know what I'm saying? So when you always let down and then you finally find somebody that show up, I tell Michael, like, you stuck with me. This is a life sentence because you showed up for me. Like, what you, I'm going to let you go. Like, you showed up for me. What the fuck? You was there the whole time. You feel me? So, and when I came home. So just community, you know, my partner always say people over profit. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have to invest in our people. We have to invest in our community. We have to invest because the money going to come and the money going to go. But good people in your corner, good people in your circle, they not. And you got to learn to trust. Like, it's hard to unlearn broken trust and broken heart. Like, you can't really learn that, but you got to learn that everybody's not. Like, I learned that I think everybody think like me. Everybody grew up like me. Everybody. So that's why I never trust nobody. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm like, nah, they got to think like me. So if they think like me, they don't know. But then I learned, like, everybody ain't like. But in order to truly find love, you got to put yourself in a position to be hurt. You know what I'm saying? Because if you don't go in vulnerable like that and open, then you're not going to truly find the people that care for you. And it's crazy that, you know, after experiencing loss and really being close to my gang and close to the hood and close to the homies, that the closest people I'm still with is the community I built while I was in prison. I'm closer to them.
You and family. Anybody else. I'm more closer to the community and the family and the friends that I have built than I am to my own blood family.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And yeah, so you understand, like, what I'm saying as far as, like, I'd be trying to preach community and
trauma and all of that is for my family. And so if I'm trying to break those cycles and those generational curses, like, you have to build a whole new family and community, and it's a process and it's very scary.
Yeah, because you have to unlearn the hurt and be able to put yourself in position to get hurt. And that's everybody's defense mechanism. Like, I ain't going to let nobody hurt me again. Yeah. But in order to truly find those people, like, I can't say I want my best friend or my friend to be real and solid and call me on my stuff. And then when they call me on my stuff, I'm just ready to leave them alone and not be their friend no more. And that's me. That's one of my toxic traits. Because I want my homies, like, you got to call me on my shit. You got to let me know when I'm f***ing up. But as soon as you do it, I'm gone. You know what I'm saying? I disappear because I really don't. So, you know, I learned that I have to be able to accept the things and the qualities that I look for in people. You can't say you want that. It's insanity to say you want that, but then when you get it, you push them away. Them is the people we push away. But it's just unlearning broken trust is ultimately what it is, and learning to trust again.
I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing. It's really fascinating. And so I, like, feel like the philosopher or something. I'm like hearing all this stuff. I'm like, oh my God. But the thing you just said is interesting, because again, folks are, like, experiencing trauma. And then the standard is, like, just let them out. And, like, the expectation is that you, like, rise to normal
and put them back in the same neighborhood.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where, like, the leaking out of the bottom. It's like the stone falls to the bottom and falls out again.
But then put another layer on it, though, because, like, him, I was not, my addiction was not a substance. And sure. So if you have a substance addiction and you have substance abuse, there is a lot of resources for you.
Sure, right.
For me, they were more so like, okay, well, go figure it out. And yeah, at some point, like, well, do you want me to be an alcoholic? Like, right. Do you want me to act like I do drugs? Like, just so that I can get the help that they're getting?
Yes.
Like, more so, like, the people that really had the substance abuse, they really get a lot of help.
Sure. Mm-hmm. It was interesting what Shalimar was saying when we met, because, you know, most of the, so Coffee Creek is the only women's prison in Oregon, which I learned and did not realize. And men are even processed at Coffee Tree.
Mm-hmm.
So a large part of that facility is actually also for men. Mm-hmm. And so all the resources are for men.
Yeah.
And so when women get out, they have no resources. And it's interesting because, like, not-for-profits that provide resources need a big artery to bite into, or they're not going to set up shop. And so it's just not even a big enough catchment in order to... But something that Quee said before is like this community, the community I'm at inside, I mean, community in general, again, for listeners, and I harp on this as much as I can, like literally anyone can do any of the things you just heard listed. Rides, sandwich, job support, you know, all these things. Sandwich. You know,
nah.
I love sandwich.
Nah.
It's interesting too, because when I moved here, I also was like precariously housed. And I met a guy, Jim, and I think not on this show, but in other facets of my life, Jim is like kind of the savior guy who like literally met me at a dog park and was like, here's the key to my house and live here. And my ID still is his address. And like, I file taxes there, but that I like, and he gave me a car and I'm literally like, and he's like, oh, it's not, it was my son's old car. I'm like, Jim, if I didn't have a car, I wouldn't be doing stuff all around Portland because I couldn't. So yeah, message to the listeners, like show up and be there. You get one last thought. We are at regulation time. We're over. We're overtime. You're in the penalty box.
But just think about how empowered. Okay. Just think about how empowered you felt for when that one person.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of tools.
That's what I try to tell him. He's like, oh, no. I'm like, man, no.
Yeah. I got one quick one, too. We keep on swinging no matter what. Like, yeah. I'm still fighting my case. I've been out, like, I don't know, 4 years or something. And I'm still fighting, and I have a non-unanimous jury, which is deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States. And I'm still fighting. Why? It's either because I'm dumb and naive or because I just don't know how to not do it. And that's what we all do. Like you said, you keep putting yourself out there, keep trying to get the job, keep trying to get the place, keep trying to get a new spot to live. And even though you get the door slammed half the time, you know. Maybe one person says yes, you know, we just keep going.
Queezy, you got one thought and you're signing this out. They're in your ear.
Hey, man, anybody can't do this, man. You got to really love it. You got to really, you know, because Michael, you've been yelled at. Michael, you done been yelled at. You done been everything, you know what I'm saying? So, like, you got to have a heart for this because you're dealing with children, really. A lot of us get locked up as children. So sometimes we come home as that, just in adult bodies. Just be patient. You know what I'm saying? Like I always say, if you're dealing with somebody that's recently incarcerated or somebody that is incarcerated, be patient. Don't put too much on them. We may act like we know everything and like we got it together, but we really need y'all help. It takes a village. Just like they say for children, it takes a village. It takes a village, man. You know what I'm saying? Keep going though. Players don't keep score. We keep scoring. 10-10.
Michael doesn't share very much. And it wasn't until he did, he did something that I was able to attend because of COVID and everything was on Zoom. And he talked about doing a, I think actually it was when he came home, how he went into the prison and asked you guys what you wanted. And he went and everybody said they wanted a stand-up comedy class. And he did that. And I thought, that's pretty cool.
That's crazy. Yeah. He's special for sure.
I agree.
Yeah.
I will say though that with everything I've been listening to, he does, you know, when I tell him how special he is, he goes, anybody can do this. And I'm thinking, because of all that you shared, that I'm going to see what sort of program we have in my neck of the woods that help women when they get out.
Yeah, I think that's great because I do feel like the system focused most on drug addiction. And it's a lot of programs for the guys coming home. It's funny because I actually lied about having a drug problem to get in a program that will get me home 90 days early. I completed it and it was co-ed. It was a lot of women and men in that class. But then I realized that a lot of the other classes was just like, it was just a lot for the men and for drug use. So to get women, because I feel like evaluation is important. You can't put three separate people who have three totally different problems in the same class to heal. Like it has to be appropriate for the behavior, for the mental stability, for the mental capacity of the person. And with the system, it's like it's one program fits all,
right?
And I think that's where the failure comes in. I know the program I was with, Liberation Literacy, what we did was everybody that was in the class, in the group inside, when they were 90 days to coming home, we got together a package specifically for them. So we had a group of people that went into the prison, and then we had a group of people who were recently incarcerated who couldn't go in. But the group that went in, I don't know if you have eligibility to go into a prison or have people go in, but when they got down to their last 90 days, which is at your last 4 months, you do your release with the, you know, address and all this different stuff. So they're already in that come home state to where they know exactly what they have and exactly what they need. And that's where we came in to say, okay, everybody don't need a backpack with clothes. Like, some people have clothes, like, you know, it's so, you know, everybody, when they got to that 90 days, we figured out what they needed specifically to help them with, you know, transitioning and being what I call your rebirth, because you get another chance. So, and I always tell Michael, like, it's, everybody can do this. A lot of people have tried, and a lot of people, they fail because the pressure is a lot. And Michael wear a lot of hats. He does a tin can phone, and working with us is just a piece. It's just a piece of what he does.
He came home one summer, I think it was, and we got a whole group of people together because there are a lot of family and friends who support mm-hmm. him. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly asking me what he's doing, and I usually never know. So we put a group together, and he did a 45-minute presentation. Mm-hmm. He did not stop for 1 second, and the whole 45 minutes, he told us about all the work he was doing. It's amazing.
Yes. He's most definitely amazing. He was the first experience with getting paid for your work from the inside. Mm. We never, well, I can, for myself, 10 years incarcerated, I never participated in a program where we got paid for the work that we did. It's usually us doing a lot of work and then the prison getting paid for it, or whatever program. They give us fundraisers like deodorants and, you know, different things like that.
Yeah, right.
But with Michael, it was like we did an art project, and it's funny because I actually ended up going to solitary confinement not too long after the project was done, and I got a check while I was in solitary confinement from Arts and Social Practice, and it was for the work that we did. And it was kind of mind-blowing to participate in something. Like, I think the win over with Michael was he showed that he cared. You know what I'm saying? Like, he,
right.
It was so many times he didn't have to come, where he even was late and came for 10 minutes. You know what I'm saying? But what he did was showed us that he will always be there. And that's the thing that's the separation from the people, like, who you open up to, who you tie to, right. And people who you just remember, like, okay, he was a cool person. And the time that we spent was a cool time. But like, when you actually there for somebody, or not even just somebody, for a group of people who the world throws away, who are considered, are deemed, you know, the monsters, and you rehumanize, because ultimately prison hides behind the illusion of rehabilitation, but there's really no rehabilitating going on.
Yeah, right.
So, it's a lot of dehumanizing going on. And when you have people come in, he don't get paid. It was never about no money for him. It was never like, even with counselors, it's like, you don't really care. Like, you get paid for this. You get therapists, you know, you get paid. We always have that, you get paid for, you know, doing something for me. And with Michael, it's like, he don't get paid. He didn't get paid for duty. He literally dedicated himself to us. And that's one of the reasons, I don't think I ever told him, but that's one of the reasons when I feel like relapsing into street activities, he's one of the people that come in my head, like, what Michael gonna think? Like, I can't let bruh down. Like, bruh done been through too much. He done been searched in metal detectors and COs looking at him crazy, and CO like he'll be having a class, but we 3, 4, 5, 6 people deep in the hallway and Michael in the middle of it, you know what I'm saying? It's all the inmates, everybody, all the boys in blue, and then you got Michael in the middle of it, and the COs is wondering, like, what's going on? But, like, when you got that energy about you, one of the things I always say to group members, to anybody who's going to step into trying reform and trying to help rehabilitate, we don't care how much you know until we know how much you care.
You care.
You know what I'm saying? And that's over everything, because you don't got to know much. But if I know you care, then we're going to figure it out together.
Right. So I'm just thankful.
I'm thankful to meet you. I'm thankful to have a conversation with you, because that's my big brother. And I love Michael. Like, you know, he's been there for me, like when times was not so good, when I was ready to go back to prison and do something, you know, and he's been there and helped me through situations. So I'm blessed to meet you, because without you, there would be no him. And so I'm thankful for that.
Well, and I'm very thankful to all of you for letting the word out. I would think that most people have no idea what goes on inside prison. Nothing.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. And it, I mean, there's so much crap going on in America now that it's embarrassing, but that's another thing we need to be embarrassed about.
Well, it's easy. It's easy when media is controlled. So they're going to paint the monsters. Yeah. They're going to show before prison. They're not going to never show. So back in the day, it was private court, public punishment. So it's changed now. It's changed to public court. Anybody could go to any court date and see what a person gets sentenced for. But punishment is private. Prison is private. I interview professors at PSU, professors at U of I. I interview students that came into the prison, volunteers, and a high percentage of them didn't even know that it was a prison in Portland itself. Right. You know, so they hid the prison, but they know people are going to jail. They know people, the bad guys are getting off the streets. But they hide what goes on the inside. And once you come in, you become a witness. And a lot of people ask me, well, what can I do? Like, I don't really have a big voice or a big platform. What can I do? And I always say, you can start by just having a conversation.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people they just don't know. Like, I hear what the news say, I hear what the media say, but I don't know. So when you say, I myself know somebody, and you can give a story, and you could give a, because word of mouth and story is everything.
Right.
That's why social media is so big, because it's just everybody's story.
Story.
It's what they want you to think it is. So when you communicate, you tell your friends, are you at a, you know, having a drink with your friends or a lunch or a brunch? And I knew somebody who was in prison. I had a conversation with an ex-con. That alone is, whoa, what do you mean? Now you have a chance to change the perspective. And when you change the perspective, you change a life. You know what I'm saying? Because now I can look differently. And it's just, it's harder and it's more work to that, but it's that simple to where just it has to be talked about, because nobody knows. The news don't talk about it. Right. Nobody knows. And then, like, even just for Michael, when you just talk to me, like, oh my God, you do all of this in this city, in this town. Like, I never even knew none of this exists. And now you can go tell, you know, and talk to so many different people. And that's the thing for me. I enjoy sophisticated ignorance. I look like I look because I come from what I come from. But you have a conversation and you're going to understand that it's a lot more than the cover. But if I change the way I look, if I change the way I present myself, the ones that I'm helping, the ones that I'm speaking for, that I'm going to be unidentifiable to them. You know, you have to, like for me, therapists, right? Counselors at school. I grew up, I'm a child of the system, from foster care to prison. All the counselors they gave me never looked like me. So I never even intended on, I just never even intended on, like, there was never going to be no healing, there was no communication, it was never going to be any of that, because I know you don't feel me. And then it goes back to that, you get paid for this, so you're going to get paid no matter what anyway.
Right.
Because we don't know how much somebody care. But as soon as I find out how much you care, none of that matters. You know what I'm saying?
I want to say that when I was listening to the initial podcasts, I was amazed at how thoughtful you were. And who was the other? Armand?
Yeah, Armand Pustos, yeah.
The things that you were expressing, how you were able to translate your experience into something that we could understand. Mm-hmm. I was just blown away that, you know, here are two ex-cons mm-hmm. having an intelligent conversation. I mean, it was just, you're right. People have no idea.
Yeah. But also, ma'am, a lot of the guys in blue, and due to cultural appropriation, glorify prison time.
Yeah.
And so I have this understanding that I can see why a certain class of people would look upon, because if we are selfish coming home, like, yeah, I did all this time in prison, I'm this big bag, macho, tattoos, all. If this is how we're continuing to present ourselves, then this right. is how the results we're going to get. So again, I always speak on presentation. It's important to know that you're automatically going to have this judgment on you. So I can't come out living like that, you know? But I say culture appropriate because in my culture and where I come from, you can't get to certain levels in your organization
right.
until you go to prison. Like, you gotta go to, you gotta go walk what we call walking the yard. You gotta go walk a yard. We call it a tour, just like going to the, and me and Armand actually had a conversation on live because I call prison a tour, because that's what we call it. That's where we go get educated. That's where we go to war. That's where we go, you know?
Right, so right.
We call, so understanding that we wear prison as a badge of honor because you got to get there to get these certain statures and to these certain levels. Well, in real life, you're only ruining your own name.
Yeah, right.
We don't understand that until 35, 40 years old when we're actually adults and trying to do the right thing. I think Michael before asked me, what will it take for someone to change? My answer and what I think is tragedy. Mm. It always takes for something tragic to happen in someone's life for them to begin to want to change.
Or something wonderful, like having a child, because that was what, I'm sorry, what was the woman's name? She did a wonderful job. Shalimar. Thank you. Thank you, Laura. Shalimar, with what changed her life was the fact that she had a child and had to take care of somebody else. That's not necessarily a tragedy.
I think you're absolutely right. But also, culture appropriate, having kids don't really change the mindset. You have to be, like, for me, yes. When I had my daughter, that changed everything for me. But I was already I went to prison at 19 years old.
Right.
I was already on a path to where I was ready to die. Every day I lived ready to die.
Oops.
Which is why now I say I have to be okay with living. Because right. every day that I walked out my door, I was okay and ready to die for what I was right. representing. So, but right. yes, you're absolutely right, ma'am. But in this culture, having kids, it's guys that they don't care. Like, it's sad, but me growing up, seeing dudes have kids never meant that they was gonna be there or be around or be like, that was just like, oh yeah, that's bruh son or that's bruh daughter. Like, that it really,
what you're identifying though is the difference then between a man and a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
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 Yeah, I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely correct.
But also, I think it's, I don't know, because for me, it changed for me. It changed. Like, it was, well, I'm one of the ones that, maybe it was the motivation, because my brother Ben, rest in peace, he already had me on a path to understand my greatness. And then my daughter was just like that. It was just like, this is that reason why. Because you got to have reason for what you do. You know, even for people who believe in certain things that I don't agree with, I always say, everyone has to believe in something.
Right.
And I won't be mad at you for what you believe in. I will always respect it. Right? So, like, yes, for me, it was, but I think just when you grow up fatherless and then you say, well, I'm cool. I'm all right. Look at me. It'll make you feel like it's going to be okay. And that's where that generational abandonment come in.
Right.
And then in order to unlearn and begin to do the work to break the cycle, you have to admit that you were taught wrong. You grew up, everything you knew was wrong. You have to admit that. And one of the biggest problems with the human is, how can I admit that I'm wrong?
Right.
I can't admit that I was raised wrong. This, my mom was wrong. My grandma was wrong. Like, you can't, it's hard to admit that. And that's what unlearning is going back and realizing, like, they raised me the best they could for that time. For that time, though.
Right.
Because as time goes, then you have to begin to grow. And you have to begin to leave certain things behind. And that's the thing with prison. A lot of us go to prison at a young age. So as time continues to grow, we stop. Right. So, like, I came home at 29 years old, but I still felt 19, 20 years old. And I felt like people were going to look the same and everything was going to be the same. Like, as far as, like, my homeboys from back in the day, I couldn't wait to see them. I couldn't, like, then they grown. They got beer bellies and kids. And I'm like, oh, wait, like, no, like, I'm the only one that's still, you know. So I always say be patient, bro, because, like, when I came home, everybody felt like everybody was waiting for my lead, for me to lead. And I'm like, I don't even know how to grocery shop. I'm used to writing it down on a piece of paper and it just come to my bunk, you know? Healing is something, like, I have a thing called Trauma Almost Won. And I always say Trauma Almost Won because I was blessed enough to identify with the behaviors and where they come from.
Right.
You know, I looked at psychology books for about 3 years. I ain't gonna say study, but I looked at some psychology books because I always wanted to figure out what was going on. You know, clearly I was a guest counselor. Clearly parents and grandparents, they didn't have the proper tools to equip us for this time, you know?
They came up in similar surroundings. Mm-hmm. They didn't have anybody showing them what to do. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
And so for me now too, that's like my mom. I love to go get my mom and I take her to hikes, to trails. Mm. It's like just that release, because I was introduced to it. Like, when you there and you close your eyes and you actually put your mind to rest and you can hear the wind going through the trees and the bird, the birds and the water at the same time.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing. And I know she suffered. Like, I know my mama suffered. Mm-hmm. I think from studying psychology, I realized one of the things that I have done is blanked out a lot of the things my mom did, the things she did wrong, the things she did wrong. It's hard for me to remember because I only remember the things she did right. You know what I'm saying?
Hey.
And it's like,
that's a good thing.
But
I'm sure if you asked her, she did the best she could.
Yeah, but the problem is I allow her to get away with those same things with my kids, with her grandkids. And it's like I can identify with it. So as I'm doing the work and I'm healing so that my kids don't go through that, I can allow you.
Right.
You know?
And right.
It's a stubborn mindset to where it's like I try to give her the things that I'm learning in doses to where she don't feel like I'm trying to change her. But so,
I was going to say, like yourself, it's not a question of changing the individual. It's expanding their mind so that they understand more.
Yeah. But it seems she get mad by approach, though. Like, when I'm like, mama, things don't go like that, Mom. I'd be like, nah, things don't go like that no more, Mama. But that's how they go for me. I'm like, ooh. So it's hard to, and I'm trying to figure out how to, like, man, it's like, now that I'm okay with identifying with the things of my, it's like, I can't, that's my baby. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's my baby. So I can't never tell her what she did wrong. I always tell her, like, it ain't nothing you did that got me to this place. Like, it ain't nothing you did that made me go to prison. Like, I chose the streets. know what I'm saying? Pops wasn't there, so right. I told her she's like nothing she did, but I'm pacifying her behavior when really it's a, I don't know, toxic, but it's kind of the same. I think she just feel like she could buy my kids, like not really be present, but grandma got you this, grandma gonna buy you this, grandma buy, and I'm like, mama, presents is the best present, you know what I'm saying? Right, like, right, right. Like,
but so now that is an American culture thing. You know, it, regardless of who
buy
you
your
are,
way out.
You suffer from thinking that buying things makes people happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then they like you because you bought them something. That's a whole other issue. Consumerism on steroids.
Damn. I don't know. I struggle. I be trying to figure out how I can. And as a mom, so. Wow.
Well, one thing for me is I try to get people not to buy anything unless they absolutely need it. Mm-hmm. Because America creates more garbage, mm-hmm. more trash than any other country. I walk in Sam's and I see, you know, the aisle where they have all those plastic bottles wrapped in plastic. Mm-hmm. It makes me sick because what are we going to do with all that crap when people, you know,
mm-hmm.
So the environment is tied into everything as well, or not, but nature is grounding for me.
Yes.
And it's important for me to protect nature. And part of that is by not being a consumer on steroids.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, I'm learning. One of my D's is never to litter again. I try so hard not to litter, and I'm just now getting connected with the elements and right. understanding like certain lands. I travel and find hikes and lakes and rivers, and that's just what me and my partner do. Like, I love it. Like, I grew up a city boy, but man, that nature is something different when you can find peace. Like, I choose peace, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think that's one of the things I want to do with Tin Can Phone. When I get back in the Portland area, put together a nature adventure for anybody program, but most definitely ex-cons. It's a lot of guys from the city who wouldn't dare touch dirt or go hiking, but because they've never been introduced to it. So,
absolutely.
You know,
that's a great idea.
I'm going to get with Michael and see if we could put something together. I've been trying to put things together from afar because mentally I'm still trying to make sure that, you know, I lose it sometimes. Like I say, relapse is close. Relapse,
you gotta take care of yourself. You cannot help anybody if you're not whole. And the fact that you can recognize when you need to step away is very good. You know, it's healing, it's self-care.
I feel like, you know, I can't tell these guys and help these guys if I'm doing the same thing they're doing. Like, I have to be the difference. And you never know who's paying attention. So I always try to be careful when I talk. I always try to be careful with the things that I do, because a lot of people won't tell you that they're watching you or that, you know, you mean something to their progression, but they watch, you know? So I always try to be careful and just, I'm just trying to, I always say I'm the voice of healing because I was so deep, mom. I was so deep in the streets, like young. I went to foster care when I was 5 years old. And, you know, my mom, she had a substance problem. So I was, that's why I say I'm a child of the system. That's why I always consider myself a child of the system. And, but like I was deep in the streets. And I see what it do, you know, like I see what it do. I see what incarceration do. And we actually have an episode of Tin Can Phone coming up with a young man who did 7 years in the juvenile facility in Oregon, McLaren. And we're going to just talk to him about, you know, I always say man versus monster. Do the system create men or do the system create monsters? Because they say we go in monsters, but the conditions of those places will create monsters also. Because usually we go in men who made mistakes. But then you create monsters.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you go in broken.
Exactly.
And they don't help. And they don't help you heal.
They break you more.
Yeah, right. They break you more. Did Michael ever tell you that his grandmother had a foster shelter? So, and a foster shelter is where they will put, you know, they take a child out of a dangerous situation, and they need to put them somewhere until they figure out where they're going to go long term, or you know what I mean, until they find a home for them. And she had over 300 children.
Oh my God.
Go through her home. And her care. And we actually have a number of foster children who have been adopted into the family.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing, because that's,
yep.
As a foster kid, you never feel like it's going to happen.
Right.
You never feel like somebody actually want me. So that's amazing, and I thank you for that. And I speak for the kids of the system. I thank you for that. That's amazing. Forever Homes. Oh, yeah. Forever Homes. Yeah. No, Michael never told me that, though, but that's great. I'm not like.
Well, and he grew up with foster children. There were always foster children at his grandmother's house. And when he was being cared for by his grandmother, which was in the early years, you know, before he went to school, the majority of children were foster children. I think there were only two or three cousins. And all the other children were foster children.
Wow. She has a great heart.
Yeah, and he does too.
No, he
and
you'll does.
You'll have to ask him about that, the experience, because he doesn't really tell me anything.
No, Mike is most definitely he's gonna talk about what's going on right now. Anything else, we'll figure that out later. Here you go. You know, that's how Mike is.
He's in the moment. He's always in the moment.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. No, he is. It blow my mind sometimes. And I just be like, I'm like, dang, like, he dealt with some of the real ones. I'm trying to figure out how I can explain real ones. Like, some of the big guy, the big dogs, you know?
Mm.
Like, some of the big dogs in there. It was even to the point where a lot of the guys wouldn't take the class, but they always wanted to talk to Michael though. Like, hey, tell Michael to come outside. And like I said, we'd have so many people out there in the hallways, which was somewhat be breaking the rules, but they kind of let it slide.
Right.
The reason all this is even put together, like, he brought the recorder in, which ended up like was kind of like contraband.
Yeah.
It was really kind of like contraband. Like, you be.
I know. Did you guys ever liberate it, or is it still there?
No. We been brought that home. We got that. we got the prize. But ma'am, we can't. So all the work we did in there, none of the material can be used because it was recorded inside the prison and they owned our voice. So the people we interviewed, they don't own their voice, but they own our voice, and we can't release it publicly without their permission. And they've been sitting on it for about 2 years now.
Oh my God.
So we just renamed and started over. We renamed and started over, and that's where Tin Can Phone is now. But the
Right. Well, they don't want people to know the truth. Exactly. They probably realize what they're doing is not a very good job.
But, and this is the thing, we never, if you listen to any episode of Tin Can Phone, we never CO bash. We never bash.
No, but you talk about how you're not prepared, how they put you on the street without letting you. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. And but it's because.
It's not a personal thing. The system is fucked up.
Yeah. And their illusion in how they get the taxpayers' money is rehabilitation. So once you, and this is the thing why Michael would experience in a lot of the college students, and they experience the same scrutiny we experience because you become a witness. So like, once you come in there, they know that once you leave,
right,
you know what it was like in there. So then they start like, they'll pat you down, or they start doing little things like, you can't bring that pen in here, and you done brought the pen every time you came. But right. once all those classes, they let those classes in. That don't mean they want them in there though. They don't want anybody in there to humanize us, to build community. And that was the whole ideology of the programs was community. And for the prison, it's like, okay, we can't stop the classes from coming in, but they begin to bother and be extra, you know, when they seen that, oh, they really coming, they're really showing up, they're really, oh, you know, now they want to nitpick at you. You can't, you know, you get searched extra hard, or, you know, you got to wait extra long outside before they open the doors for you, or, you know, they just start doing all type of things like that. And it's because they know that now you have witnessed the truth of the incarceration, because those COs, they stick together, and they're like, I try to get people to lose the us versus them mindset. We're going to always lose because
right.
They are in power of us, you know? So
they didn't appreciate the fact that there was positive change.
Well, job security. They don't want us coming home positive. They
need to come back.
Yeah, they need us
to come back.
And that's why I don't trust parole, because if I do the right thing and you let me off parole, you're losing a check. You're losing a part of your, you know, and this next person and the next person and the next person. Like, if you let us off parole, then you lose your money. So that's, again, like systematic slavery. It's the same thing as convict leasing. You know what I'm saying? Just from one agency. When I came home, I was at a subsidy shoreline housing. I was taking UAs for 3 or 4 different agencies, but I never took a UA for my actual parole officer. But I took a UA at the place I lived. I took a UA at the class I was in. I took a UA for like, I was taking all these different UAs for all these different people. And I was doing so much different work for so many different agencies. It felt like convict leasing in a sense, like not as intense as in the Jim Crow times, but going through all these different agencies and having to perform, I guess, for freedom, which never really comes. Me personally, I've been home for 2 years. My parole officer doesn't put too much pressure on me, but he keeps me in a position to have to do something. Like, it's never like, okay, you did everything I asked you to do, now I'm gonna terminate you. It's always like, do this one more thing. And, you know, so, but yeah, that's a gist of how this goes.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I'm glad I was able to meet you. I thank you for the conversation. Thank you to everybody that stayed. I appreciate you guys.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, lovely meeting you, Nancy.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you. You
all guys right, everybody, are amazing. I'm gonna go to bed. It's 11 o'clock here.
Oh, wow.
It feels like 11 o'clock in my head, too.
Oh, it's still light out where you are.
And yeah, I'm just tired.
Laura, thanks so much to VanSport for, it's just wonderful.
It's just a beautiful community.
You are listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast, where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the sources. We tell the stories from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on cable community radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m. You can also check us out on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere you love to catch your podcast. And make sure to give us a follow over at 10canphonepodcast.com. And follow our Instagram at 10canphonepodcast. This Misfit Adi signing off. Hey.